The book of Titus, chapter 2 and verse 11, the apostle said, "For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men, instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires, and to live sensibly, righteously, and godly in the present age." To live godly in the present age, that's a challenge for everyone, no matter the specific age in which they may live, because we're all living in an age this side of the return of Christ. We're living in an age, we're living in a world that's dominated by Satan. It's not how we would like it, perhaps not even how it should be, but that's how it is. And so our challenge is to keep our focus on God and to keep our outlook on spiritual things. And that's really what the word godly suggests. Someone who is focused on God. And we dare not just mimic and get all caught up in the things of the present age and lose that perspective. This has been a point of emphasis for us this year. We've had several lessons beginning from this passage, talking about different aspects of what it means to live a godly life in the present age. Surely all of us would agree that for our application, living in the 21st century in the United States, the present age is a money-oriented age. It is an age that's all about stuff, and it's all about accumulation, and it's all about dollars and cents. So how do we live a godly life in the financial side of things? That's what we want to talk about a little bit this morning. The godly approach to finances. What does the Bible have to say about what our outlook on those things ought to be and our behavior ought to be in this regard? 7 is a good Bible number. It's not too practical for preaching because it takes two hands, but anyway. It's a good Bible number. So I want you to think with me about 7 points this morning that the Bible makes about the godly approach to finances. We'll begin in Luke chapter 12, where the Lord made the point that that's not what life's all about. And that's the first thing and perhaps the overriding thing we need to remember, that life's not all about money. In this place, in Luke chapter 12, Jesus was teaching on some very lofty themes, and all of a sudden, in the middle of his sentence, someone stopped and interrupted him and said, "Lord, teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." The Lord refused. And he said in verse 15, "Beware, and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." And he told him a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops?' Then he said, 'This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" This man had a great retirement plan, that he had it all set. It was all lined up, and all he had to do was take it easy the rest of his life. But he'd missed something. In fact, he had missed the most important thing. He had missed what life is all about. Jesus said, "Not even when a man has an abundance does his life consist of the things that he has." That's not what life is about. Life is about relationships, not things. And chief among relationships is our relationship with God. The Lord Himself asked in another place in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 16, He asked, "What will a man profit if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul?" And so the first thing that the Bible would remind us of when we're talking about the godly approach to finances is that we not get all caught up in that and get to thinking that that's the main thing that matters, or that's the solution to life, or that's the source of happiness, or keep it in perspective. Money is nothing more than a tool to be used. It's not the objective. Serving God is the objective in life. Let's not lose track of that. That's our first thing. Number two, the Bible tells us that we need to get busy and work to make our way through life. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 10, middle of the verse beginning. The apostle says, "We urge you, brethren, to excel still more and to make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your hands, just as we commanded you, so that you will not behave properly, or so that you will behave properly toward outsiders and not be in any need." We were studying Adam and Eve in our Bible class here just a couple of weeks ago, and one of the questions that I had asked was, what were the basic provisions that God gave to Adam and Eve back there in the garden? And we might note that God did not give Adam and Eve any money back there in the garden. But God did give them work to do. He gave the man work to do even before sin came into the world. When sin came in, the work got harder. But man had to work from the beginning. That's good for us. It's fundamental to who and what we are. And so the apostle encourages us in this place to work with our hands. And that's true of everyone. Every single person needs to learn that he or she is expected to make their own way through life. We're not here for family to take care of. We're not here for society to take care of us. We're supposed to make our own way. And I'm not suggesting by that there's not a place for family or church or society or whatever for some help along the way in certain circumstances. But we dare not develop the mentality that somehow everybody just owes me an existence and owes me a living because I'm here. I have to make my way. Now, that's true of everyone, but the apostle was especially making a point to Christians in this regard. He says, "I want you to do that so you will behave properly toward outsiders and not be in any need." Christians are to be examples. Godly people are to be examples of what we ought to be and to live our lives in such a way as the best we can to take away sources of criticism from the world so that we can be lights to the world. So to this young congregation, and I say young, that is, they were young in the faith, Paul gave these instructions. A few months later, he wrote another letter, 2 Thessalonians, because evidently not everyone who had heeded what he told them to do in this place. And he got a report back that this was still a problem at Thessalonica, that there were some there who just weren't working. And so in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, he came back to the subject with even stronger language. He said to them in 2 Thessalonians 3, beginning in verse 10, he said, "Even when we were with you, we used to give you this order, if anyone is not willing to work, then he's not to eat either. For we hear that some among you are leading an undisciplined life, doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. Now such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to work in quiet fashion and eat their own bread." Get to work, said the apostle. And I want you to notice that in both of those places, the apostle uses the word quiet in reference to work. He said in 1 Thessalonians 4 to lead a quiet life and to work with your own hands. He says in this place to work in quiet fashion. What exactly is he talking about when he says work in a quiet fashion? Well, some think the word quiet is used here in contrast to the noisiness or the busybodies that some of these had become. Some have suggested quietness here is in contrast to the kind of an agitated state that seemed to characterize some of these Christians, and a part of that was a misconception that they had that the Lord was coming again just any day. Others have suggested that the quietness in both places seems to be the idea of working in such a way as not to disturb the quiet of others, so as not to become a burden on others and be a disruption to their life. Because that's what we are when we won't make our own way. We become a disruption and a problem to other people. And the apostle doesn't want us doing that. But I think there might be some other explanation for that in addition to those points, all of which are true. When he says in verse 12 of 2 Thessalonians 3, I want you to work in quiet fashion and eat your own bread, maybe he's just saying, I want you to work and just do it. Don't make a big deal about it. Don't act like that somehow you're being put upon because you're expected to get a job and work and make your own way through life. Don't act like that's some big deal. That's just a part of life. So, quietly go on about your business of making your way through life. Now, if we're going to do this, if we're going to earn our own way, if common sense would tell you, a couple of things need to happen. Number one, somewhere along the line, we've got to develop a work ethic. We've got to learn how to work. We've got to learn how to get up on the mornings we don't feel just the very best. We've got to learn how to stay at a task that sometimes gets a little tedious, or maybe it's not our favorite thing to do. We've got to learn how to put up with people that aren't always exactly ideal in terms of how we interact. We've got to learn to work. And that's one of the things parents need to teach their children, need to instill in them a good work ethic. And then obviously we've got to develop some sort of marketable skill somewhere along the way. Maybe you go to college. Maybe college is not for you. But you need to learn how to do something where you can be productive in life. Something that you can make a living at, that you're interested in doing, that you're capable of doing, and that you're able to find a job. Because that's what the Lord wants us to do. The godly approach to finances is that we work to pay our way. Once again, this is not the main thing. It's not all about money. Life's about serving God, but a part of serving God is working to make our own way through. Number three, pay your bills. Romans chapter 13, in verse 8, the apostle says, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. In the preceding verse, he had said, render to all what is due them. New American Standard rendered. The word due in verse 7, what's due someone else, and the word owe in verse 8, owe nothing to anyone, is the same word in the original. Some translations reflect that. The English Standard, for example, suggests in verse 7 to pay to all what you owe them, and then verse 8, don't owe anything to anyone. And at first that seemed almost backwards. Well, wait a minute, pay everything you owe, but don't owe anything. Well, he's talking about some different contexts a little bit there. In verse 7, he's finishing up his discussion of the obligation that Christians have, all people have in fact, towards civil government. And he's talking about obligations or debts that we have because we are citizens in a government. And it may be obligations of respect and honor. It may be financial obligations. It's all of the above. In verse 8, that just broadens and goes beyond simply our obligations or debt to government to our obligations and debt to people in general. And in that place, he says that we ought not to be in debt to anyone except for the ongoing debt of loving one another. And so, we need to pay our way. In the book of Proverbs, chapter 22 and verse 7, the wise man observed that the rich rule over the poor and that the debtor becomes a slave to the lender. One of the things that obviously we need to do if we're going to pay our bills is we've got to learn to live within our means. We've got to learn there's something we don't have money for. I can't afford that. Maybe my next door neighbor can afford that. Maybe other folks I know, maybe other folks at church can afford that, but I can't afford that. I don't have the money for that. And so I have to learn how to say no to that. And in order to do that, we've got to get a little sense of priority. What really matters and what doesn't in life? What's important or not? Years ago in another place, I was serving as a deacon, and one of our members had requested that she could use some financial assistance from the congregation. She said she didn't have any money for groceries. So one of the other deacons and I went over to visit with her to kind of find out what was going on, find out what the needs were, what we could do. The first thing we noticed when we went in is the TV was on and the cable TV station was running. And I'll just tell you, it struck us a little bit odd. Wait a minute, we don't have any money for groceries, but we got money for cable TV. Does something seem a little out of kilter here? But that's kind of the way some folks' thinking is in terms of what's essential and what's not, and what's a priority and what's not. We got money for things we could do just fine without, but we're coming up short on the money for the things that are really essential to life. So maybe the first thing we need to do is stop, rethink some of that and get our priorities a little bit in order. But this goes to the fundamental issue of being God-fearing, honest, reliable people. And that's the next thing that we want to talk about, which is the importance of being honest in every transaction. Paying your bills is a part of it. Proverbs chapter 11. The book of Proverbs has a lot to say about finances and money and doing business. Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 1 says of God, a false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is His delight. Now you just need to remember when you read that proverb about how folks did business back in those days. There really wasn't a great deal of coined currency at the time where a coin would represent a certain value the way we have coins or paper money that represents certain value. Things tended to be weighed, a lot of barter system, and you weighed not only the goods to be sold, but you also weighed whatever you were paying with. You weighed the gold or the silver or whatever you were using for payment. For example, when Abraham bought from Ephron the Hittite that famous field with the cave in it, the cave of Machpelah, the book of Genesis describes how Abraham weighed out to him 400 shekels of silver. And so you have merchants here with their scales, and you have the merchants with their weights. You perhaps have a buyer who has his own set of weights. And so it comes time to pay, well, you put the scales on, and first thing you have to hope the scales are fair and honest. And then when the merchant or the vendor, whoever, is putting weights in the scales, and he says, now this weight is a shekel, and incidentally, shekel was originally a weight. The word itself means to weigh. You'd put that weight in there, you'd hope that really was a shekel. In modern times, if you put a pound weight in there, well, if that thing weighed 18 ounces instead of 16, then it was going to take more gold or silver to bring those scales back into balance again, wasn't it? That's what the proverb is talking about. A false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is His delight. In other words, God expects all of us to be honest in our transactions, whether we're buying or selling. In Proverbs 16, in verse 11, we have a similar kind of statement with one added detail. Proverbs 16, in verse 11, says, a just balance and scales belong to the Lord. All the weights of the bag are His concern. All the weights. You'd have heavy ones, you'd have light ones, depending on exactly what you're trying to make up here. I don't know what that says to you, but that says to me that God cares about every transaction. He cares even about the little weights, not just the big ones. He wants us to be meticulously honest in how we do business. And so, we need to be careful as purchasers, as sellers. We need to be careful as workers and as employers that we be honest in every way possible. Paul told the Corinthians on one occasion that he was going out of his way not only to do that which was honorable in the sight of God, but also honorable in the sight of men. And it gets back to that idea of being a light in the world. But we need to not only be honest, we also need to be honorable and fair and equitable in our treatment of others. Not taking undue advantage of them, but making sure that we are dealing fairly with others. Proverbs 28 says in verse 8, "He who increases his wealth by interest and usury gathers it for him who is gracious to the poor." In other words, if you gather all your wealth by means of taking advantage of other people, instead of really dealing fairly with them, ultimately, you're going to lose it. God will see to it that it gets to someone who will be more gracious and who will deal more fairly with others. Proverbs 11 and verse 26 talks about the man who withholds grain. Think of a time of need, and here's a fellow that's got the commodity that you need. Maybe it's a time of in our circumstance where there's a shortage of gas, and so the local station pumps up the price an extra dollar a gallon to make a profit. Well, the proverb says the people will curse him, and that's exactly what happens, isn't it? So the point is to deal honestly and deal fairly with others. And maybe we just ask ourselves this question. Am I conducting myself in this transaction in such a way that as soon as we're finished with the transaction, I will be in a position to talk to this person about becoming a Christian? Is there anything in the way I'm conducting myself that's going to make it such that it's going to be hard for me to try to convert this man because of how I've just handled myself? Because, as Paul said, we need to conduct ourselves rightly toward outsiders. Number five, when it comes time to spend what we take in, let's be sure and save a little sum of it to share with someone else. In Ephesians 4, chapter and verse 28, the apostle says, "He who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with the one who has need." The apostle says not only do we need to make our own way here, but we also need to have enough left that we can share it with someone else. Jesus said, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." Now that statement's not recorded in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. It's actually recorded in the book of Acts. Didn't put that on the screen. It's in Acts chapter 20, as the Apostle Paul was talking to the elders from the church at Ephesus. He said, "You need to remember the word which the Lord said, that is more blessed to give than to receive." And it really is. What's the blessing in giving anyway? Well, one thing the blessing of giving does is it reminds us that, as Job said this morning, "I brought nothing into the world and I can take nothing out of it either." It reminds us that we can't keep it. It reminds us that everything that we have has been entrusted to us by God, that we are God's stewards and that we need to use it in the way that God wants us to use it. Sharing with others is a way of being like Christ. "Though he was rich, he became poor for your sake, that through his poverty you might become rich," said the apostle to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 8 chapter. It makes us like the Lord to learn to give of ourselves and to share with those who have no need, or who have need, because that's where we were. And he shared so richly with us. And it teaches us the real joy service. Jesus said greatness is not to be measured in being served, but in serving. And sharing and giving and helping with others is one means of learning that lesson and applying it. Number six, we also need to have fellowship in the Lord's work. In the 2 Corinthian letter, Paul was writing to them about a contribution, a commitment that this congregation had made to help out some brethren in other places. The Corinthians had made the commitment that they were coming up a little short on fulfilling that commitment. And so the apostle is writing them on this subject so that by the time he got to town, everything would be in readiness. And he says to them in 2 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, beginning in verse 1, "Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God which has been given in the churches of Macedonia, that in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much urging for the favor of participation or sharing or fellowship in the support of the saints. And this not as we expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God." In verse 4, the apostle uses the word fellowship to describe this collection that the Corinthians were taking up and then the use of that in the Lord's service. In verse 1, he used the word grace to describe that. It's a grace or it's a favor from God. But it's a means of fellowship. It's a means of sharing. The collection that we take up on the Lord's Day is a means of the members of this congregation sharing together in the Lord's work. It's not the only means of that, but it is a means of that. And the priority we give to that individually is a reflection of the priority we give to the work that we're doing. I'm not saying that the person that gives $100 is making it a bigger priority than the person that gives $10. That misses the point. It's how much I participate in this in contrast to how much I spend my dollars on other things that reflects what a priority I'm making about this work. And if my participation in this work is pretty low down in the budget level, that means that I'm not making much of a priority of that. Each one of us has to decide that for themselves. How important is that? And how much does my level of participation reflect the importance that I'm placing on that? In the Philippian letter, Paul uses the same expression, fellowship. The Philippian church had just sent some of their contribution to Paul, who was in prison at the time he wrote this letter, and he expressed gratitude for them. Philippians 4 and verse 15, he said, "You yourselves know also, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel after I left Macedonia, no church shared with me or had fellowship with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. For even at Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs." Now watch verse 17. "Not that I seek the gift itself, but I seek for the profit which increases to your accounts." Paul wasn't so much concerned about what could be done with the money that was contributed, what good would come out of that. He was even more concerned about what that said about the people who were contributing it. But he says, "I've received everything in full and have an abundance. I am amply supplied, having received from Epaphroditus what you have sent, a fragrant aroma, an acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God." So, a part of the godly perspective on finances is for us to work in order to make our way and to save some of that to share with others, and also to have some to participate in the Lord's work. Number 7. Last thing. Learn to be content. The same apostle in the same text, just a few verses earlier, says, verse 10, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having an abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. Nevertheless, you have done well to share with me in my affliction. Paul wrote this letter. He was in prison. He didn't have any money. Probably didn't have any food. He didn't have any close associates much. Most of them had left to go other places and serve. His health was bad. He was awaiting trial before Nero. We might just as soon execute him as not. And he said, I've learned to be content. None of that matters. Why? Because of the first thing we started with. That's not what life's all about. It's about our relationship with the Lord, first and foremost. And when that's as it ought to be, everything else can be kept in perspective, and we can learn to be content. To the Hebrews, in Hebrews the 13th chapter, verses 5 and 6. The author said, let your way of life be free from the love of money, being content with what you have. And he reminded them that the Lord would be with them. Again, that's written to people who were suffering a great deal. In chapter 10, he talked about how these people had undergone the confiscation of their goods because they were Christians. But he said to them, do not throw away your reward. Do not throw away your hope, which has a great reward. You just keep on serving the Lord. And everything else will take care of itself. And there are other things, of course, that the Bible says in terms of specifics about our dealing with finances, but those are the basics. The godly approach to life when it comes to finances. It all begins with a focus on God. Is He the focus of your life? Are you serving the Lord, not only in this area, but in all areas of life? That's what it means to be a Christian. Being a Christian is not just wearing a name. Being a Christian is not just having your name on a church roll somewhere. It's not even showing up for services on Sunday. Those things are all important. Worship's important. A lot of things are. But being a Christian, first and foremost, is about Jesus being the Lord of your life and serving Him in the way you live, 24/7. If He's not the Lord in your life, you need to make Him that, because salvation is the outcome. It's what He promises to those who are His disciples. Will you confess faith in Jesus and be baptized into Him today for the forgiveness of your sin? If you're ready to do that, step to the front. Let's stand and sing.